Okay, great. Yeah, Shukrach, everybody who comes together to work together and have this year on a regular basis and to host this year. All right, so we got up to Nitzchila of the Avodah Zarah Hayah Lusenu. I'll just review what we said last time very briefly. Tonight is supposed to be our last year. Whether we're going to get through Maggid tonight, I have no idea. But don't count on it. But we'll do our best. I also, by the way, I have notes. I mean, everything I have here is on my notes. If anybody's interested in seeing a copy of my notes, it's shorthand, obviously, and it's not written out. And there's some, you know, Rashi Tevos and other things. But if you think it might be helpful to you to review what we've done and to see the stuff that we don't get to, I'm more than happy to send it out. So just let me know afterwards. I can send it to the group or something, whatever makes sense. All right, so we said, if you have your Haggadah outline in front of you, or a Haggadah, so we have this paragraph in Mitzchila of the Avodah Zarah Hayah Avosenu, that our forefathers were idol worshippers. We said this is the beginning of one of the main parts of Maggid. This is the spiritual version of Maschil B'Gnus Misayim B'Shvach, of the negative aspects of our forefathers. And again, we're trying to do, you know, like one little point about each paragraph. And we asked here, who were the idol worshippers that were referred to here? So I think we mentioned this last time. There was actually three different opinions about it. The simple explanation, if you look at the paragraph, is that it's Terach. Okay, he's the one that's mentioned here, as obviously an idol worshipper. But you think about that, okay, that's very nice, but what does that have to do with the Seder? So there are some answers of why Terach is important for the Seder, not specifically Terach, but, you know, the background of going all the way back in Jewish history. But on a pshat level, it's hard to understand, like, why is he being brought in here, other than the fact that he's in the Pasuk in Yehoshua, which is quoted here. And the other explanations that are given are that maybe it was Avraham, meaning that Avraham himself was one of our forefathers. But Avraham himself may have been an idol worshipper before he became from, I guess we'll call it, before he became Baal Tshuva. I don't know what you want to call it. But according to some, he was like 30 or 40 when he discovered God. And before that point, he was an idol worshipper. He minded the store, and at some point, obviously, he came around. But that's what the Ritva says. I'm sorry, that's the Rosh Beitz. That's what he says, that's Avraham. And others say it wasn't just Avram, it was actually the Jews in Mitzrayim. I think we mentioned this last time, right? And that makes the most sense in terms of the Haggadah. And we're talking about Maschil B'Gnus Misayim B'Shvach. So it's very nice if, you know, Avram was an idol worshipper, but if we're talking about Yetzias Mitzrayim, it makes even more sense to say that if the Jews were idol worshippers and they're the ones that came out, that's even better. So that's what many Farshim say based on Psukim and Yechezkel, where they actually talk about the Jews in Egypt that were worshipping idols, and Hashem told them to stop, and they had to, it didn't quite work, and they were very, very bad, and eventually, you know, he gave them the Korban Pesach, and they came around. But that's the other explanation. Maybe it refers to Klai Yisrael in Egypt. Anyway, that's basically the explanation there, and as we said, this paragraph is basically going through the background to Yetzias Mitzrayim, up to the point of Yaakov Uvanav Yerdu Mitzrayim, which is the last line in the paragraph. We won't go into it now, but if you actually look up the Pasuk in Yehoshua, you'll see that's actually not the end. Okay, the rest of it actually says, and then Hashem says, and I sent Moshe and Miriam, or Moshe and Aaron, to redeem them, and they came out, and etc., etc., etc. It goes on. But the Haggadah at this point is not interested in that. Okay, what's the Haggadah interested at this point? We didn't get to the flavor yet. Okay, this is just the background. So the Haggadah sort of stops the story in the Pesukim right in the middle, right where it gets to the point of Yaakov and his sons go down to Egypt, and that's the point where we're getting up to in the Haggadah, where we actually go through the Pesukim. We'll get to that in a minute about the slavery. Okay, there's lots of nice ideas that I can share with you. We're not going to go into it now. Just mention one nice idea that I saw in the name of Cook, who basically says that that Avram worships idols. It says that apparently what he did is that his idea was that he used his own traits and the way that he worships idols, whatever characteristics he had, which involved passion and getting intensity and emotion, that he turns around the traits and uses the same traits when he worships God. So Rukuk's point was basically, it shows that you can be you, even if you're a different person before you get close to HaKadosh Baruch Hu and after you get close to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. You don't have to change, I mean, you could change in terms of what you do, but you don't have to change your personality. Some people think, like, when you frim out, you, like, go off the deep end, you know, and you lose your personality and you become like an automaton and a robot. So if Cook is saying that's not necessarily the case, you can learn from Avraham, according to this understanding at least, that Avraham worships idols with a certain passion and intensity. So you can still use the same ideas when you serve HaKadosh Baruch Hu in the positive sense. Okay, next paragraph. It says here, Baruch Shomer Achachaso Yisrael Baruch Hu. Hey, blessed is Hashem who keeps his promise to the Jewish people. Okay, what's his promise? So look what it says here. HaKadosh Baruch Hu Chisha V'Sakeis La'asot Skimash Ha'am Ar La'avem Avinu V'Rishvenu V'Sarim.
HaKadosh Baruch Hu basically, he calculated the end to do exactly what he said to Aaron Avinu, where it says that you should know that your descendants are going to be strangers in strange land, etc., 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 etc. Okay. So first, what's he talking about here? Meaning, what's the context of this paragraph? So we're talking about the Bris Din HaBesarim. Yeah, this is the promise that Hashem gave to Aram, that Aram Avinu was going to turn into a great nation. And that the way that's going to happen is basically through the Jewish people going to Egypt, right? Becoming slaves and then coming out, they're going to come out with a lot of possessions, either physical possessions or spiritual possessions. First question, two points on this very quickly. Number one, what is this paragraph doing here? Why do we have this paragraph? Before, we just read about Ovdia Gorazariu Avosenu going down to Mitzrayim. And before we actually give the explanations of the Pesukim, this paragraph is here. Thank you, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, for calculating the end and telling Avram beforehand. What's the point? Why is this here? What's the goal of this paragraph? Any suggestions? What do you think that HaKadosh trying to emphasize here, to highlight, by thanking HaKadosh Baruch Hu for telling Avram before actually telling you what happened in Egypt?
They were saying it's all from God.
Oh, exactly, right. And so what? The point is that it's all from God, and we know that already even before
we start
exactly
about the slavery.
Right, even before we go down to Mitzrayim, we already know how HaKadosh Baruch Hu planned out the whole thing. I don't want to say the whole thing was a setup, but basically, you know, not really the right word, but you get the idea. I mean, the point was that HaKadosh Baruch Hu sent them down to Mitzrayim. The whole thing was all his plan. He told Avram already many years before that you should know that this is going to happen. Why is that important for us? Meaning, why is it important for us to know that and thank HaKadosh Baruch Hu for that? What's the point of thanking Hashem for that purpose? How do you understand why that's an important idea in general?
I don't think that the Galus is just going to happen.
Right. Meaning, at every stage of history, I think we mentioned this last time also, every stage of history is basically HaKadosh Baruch Hu's plan. We may not understand it. We may not know which point we are along the way. We know we're somewhere. We hope we're close to the end at this point, at least in history, God willing. But the point is that it's all part of HaKadosh Baruch Hu's plan. And the same way that HaKadosh Baruch Hu told Avram many years before, you should know this is what's going to happen. They're going to be slaves, it's going to be hard, and then they're going to come out. So too, we have to thank HaKadosh Baruch Hu for taking care of that. I mean, we know that he's in charge and he's doing everything. So too for us and for all of Jewish history, really, is that's what it's about, understanding that that he's taking charge and he's making sure that the order of what's supposed to happen actually comes to be. I think that's what's going on here. Before we even get into the slavery at all in the Pesukim, we say thank you, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, for giving us a heads up, so to speak, and saying this is what's going to happen. And in addition, which we're not going to go into now, the idea of chishav esaket, making the slavery shorter. Okay, this is a whole discussion also. How did HaKadosh Baruch Hu make the slavery shorter? So you probably know this. The standard understanding is that it was supposed to be, it says here, that it was supposed to be Arba Meot Shana, right, 400 years. And how many years was it really, do they say? 210, right, that's what they say. So there's a whole discussion, well, how did it get shortened and why did it get shortened? So we won't go into that now. But again, it's interesting. Some say, you know, maybe it's because Hashem was afraid they were going to get too much into Avodah Zarah. Like if they got too deep in, they wouldn't be able to get themselves out. There are other ideas, maybe, that he made the slavery more intense during the 210 years to be nice to them so that it would be faster to get out, more intense, but faster, whatever the case is. One last point about this paragraph before you go to the next one. And that is, why in the world do we need Galus in the first place? Meaning, it's very nice that Hashem tells Avram, okay, let's go to Egypt. Your people, your descendants will be slaves in Egypt, and then they're going to come out. And you could see Avram maybe saying, thank you very much, Hashem, but like, why do they have to go to Egypt? Meaning, why can't they become a great nation here in Eretz Yisrael without the difficulty and the hardship?
Hard to build.
Talk to me, yeah,
they
you're right.
Build you and they, if you don't have that, then you stop believing.
Right.
If you believe through the hardship, then even when it's easy, you're going to still believe.
Okay, good. So that's, again, this is not the...
Rabbi Spolter just talking about.
Exactly, right. But sometimes you need the negatives. On Tuesday night, he gave a nice little share about looking at going from the negative to the positive, that you have to fail before you can succeed. You can talk to all of us here. You know, we failed many times at whatever we've tried to do, and eventually, hopefully, at some point, we succeed. But depending on your definition of success, I guess. But here, you know, the idea is that you need the hardship, you need the slavery. Again, this is not easy to hear. If you think about it in practical terms, what does this mean? It means 200 years the Jews were slaves in Egypt with backbreaking labor and being whacked by the Egyptians without any hope for the future. You know, 200 years. We're not talking about 5 years of the Holocaust, which was also terrible and obviously in a different league. But 200 years, my goodness. You know, you can imagine that the people growing up there and getting old, like the entire life they were slaves, right? From childhood until death, they were slaves. And you're supposed to think, how are these people supposed to say there's any hope at all? And it's very difficult. But yet apparently that's the way, in order to build a nation, you have to have an experience of everybody together going through something like this, which again is hard to internalize and hard to accept. But that's apparently what's going on here, that needs to happen in order for the Jewish people to come out. Rav Tal, if you've seen it, he has a new sefer that just came out already last year on Pesach, Tal Chaim, his series. I think it was already out last year. So he's got some very, very nice sichot there. As opposed to the Purim one where I mentioned to you that some of them were drunk. I don't think he wrote any of these when he was drunk. I don't think. But anyway, so I saw one piece in there where he talks about this point a little bit. And he says also, in addition to that, that there's another idea here, that when the Jews came out of Egypt, they had to be starting with nothing. They had to be at zero. They had to be like matzah, totally, thin and nothing else there. Why is that? Because they have to realize everything came from HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Meaning if they came out with anything at all, other than what Hashem gave them, then they wouldn't realize it was from him. They would say, oh, it's us, it's this, it's that. They wouldn't understand the whole point. But the point is, because they were so low for so many years, it was so clear to them that only Hashem was able to take them out. And because of that, they had to realize what was happening and thank HaKadosh Baruch Hu for that, and realize that they're Avdei Hashem. That the Avdei Hashem has to happen only because of the fact that they went through this period of Golus. Okay. Anyway, there's a lot more to talk about here, but we'll save it at that for now. Next paragraph, the Hish Amda Lavusein of Alanu. Okay, and this is what stood up for us and our forefathers. Not only one person, Shalach Abdulvada Madalit Khalusainu, Al Shabhold over every generation. They try to destroy us and Kadash Baruch Hu saves us. So this of course is a continuation of the last paragraph, where we said, thank you, Hashem, for keeping your promise. And here we say, and that stood for our forefathers. What stood for our forefathers? What's the he? Anybody? That's an interesting one. That's a nice drasha. That's not the pashup shot, but that's a nice drasha. Okay, and maybe the drasha that HaKadosh Baruch Hu has the shechina, the female shechina, stood up for our forefathers. On a pashup shot level, there's some other explanations that you could probably guess what they might be based on the last paragraph what we just said. What would you guess?
Meaning
the shvua of the bris band of Yisarim, basically. I mean, that's what some people said. It's what some of the mafarshim in the Torah Chaim have got to say. It's the bris band of Yisarim, meaning the fact that the promise to basically the Jews to go through Egypt and to come out, that promise basically has stood up for our forefathers and for us. And the same promise that the Jews should leave Egypt also is the same promise that HaKadosh Baruch Hu will save us from the hands of the goyim throughout history. Meaning it wasn't just a one generation promise or one, 100 years promise. It was a promise throughout Jewish history that Hashem we will be in some difficult situations. But Hashem is never going to let us get totally destroyed. There might be plenty of Jews that are killed, unfortunately, but Hashem will always save us as a people, meaning we'll never die out. And you look at Jewish history, that's exactly what happens. Meaning it's amazing how we've lived, been scattered across the globe, have tons of different people try to wipe us out, and somehow we survive it all. Again, individually, unfortunately, a lot of difficulties and a lot of destroying Jews, but overall, as a people, we're still around, and we're thriving. Amazing, really amazing. So that's part of the idea of the Bris Ben of Yisarim and the promise to judge the other nations and to save us. That's all back to the Bris Ben of Yisarim. Okay, there's more explanations with Rav Naftali Lavender. If you were there, those of you who were at the Tuesday night thing, so he gave another little shot, which was that the Vihi refers to the wine. This is the point where you pick up the wine, the post can say. Pick up the wine, you cover the matzah, and you pick up the wine, you say, Vihi Shamzal of Hussein of Alanu. So the simple shot is you do that to show you exclaim thanks to Hashem over a cup of wine. But the drasha is that it actually the hiyat here refers to the cup of wine. The idea that we separate from the goyim and that we have rules of stam yenom and yayin nesach that you can't drink with goyim, whatever the story is, or whatever the halachas are, that keeps us separate from the non-Jews and that allows HaKadosh Baruch Hu to save us if we show that we are distinct from the rest of the world, which again is another nice idea to keep in mind. As much as we love secular culture, and as much as we want to be like the rest of the world and we want to wear the same clothes as them, we want to get the same technology as them, and we want to have the same types of food and other types of things to make everything comfortable. I just saw today, this morning on Rosh Sheva, there was a whole thing about Ziploc bag fever comes to Israel, something like that, or grips the holy nation. You see what I'm talking about? Mm-hmm. So it's like this whole article about that they're actually apparently real Ziploc bags now in Israel. They've had other kinds of bags, but not the actual Ziploc bags. So the whole article, these people are like so excited, they went to the store, and they saw these Ziploc bags, and they felt, wow, we finally made it, we finally made it here. So, okay, that's very nice, very nice, obviously. But when it comes to the real stuff, you have to realize that the real stuff that we are trying to be separate from everybody else, the Ziploc bags is nice, but that's not what defines us as Jews. And I'm sure that they know that also. Just it was funny in this context, just to keep our eyes on the our eyes on the ball, as they say. Okay, next paragraph. Seu lamad, ma bikesh Lavan Arami lasos Yaakov Avinu. Okay, it says, go and learn what Lavan Ha'arami wanted to do to Yaakov Avinu, because Paro did not
decree El Al Zacharim. He only wanted to get rid of the males, and Lavan wanted to get rid of everybody. Now, hold on, stop right there. Wait, Lavan? Kill everybody? Where did that come from? Anybody here know any ideas where this comes from? It's very strange. If you look in the Chumash, in the Tanakh, you will not find anywhere that it says that Lavan tried to kill Yaakov and all of his family. What in the world is Haggadah talking about here?
Well, there was sort of an implication when Hashem says, don't do anything to Yaakov.
Okay, good. Excellent. So that's what some of the Farshim say. I forgot which ones. I didn't write down who said it here, but somebody says that that exactly that prophet that Josh mentioned, that he says that Hashem comes to Lavan.
I
could hurt you, but I won't. But don't do anything bad to Yaakov. So some say from there we see that Lavan actually did want to take Yaakov and his whole family captive and either kill them or do whatever he wanted to do to them. So it is possible that he wanted to do that. That's number one. Number two, anybody else have any other suggestions what this might mean?
Well, there's this whole drash about Yitzhak and Eliezer. How's it go? If it's a little bit of a lumdish thing,
right.
But it goes like this: that if somebody sends their shliach to marry somebody,
right.
And their shliach
right.
never comes back, then everybody in the world is usher to him, essentially,
right.
because you don't know that who he is married
right.
to. It could
right.
be a sister,
right.
or brother,
okay.
whatever it is.
Okay.
Yeah, but so therefore, when Avram sent Eliezer to they right. wanted to poison him, but he
right.
Hashem helped and switched the food,
right.
and the father got whatever.
Right.
So that was sort of a way that they wanted to kind of he wanted to cancel.
Uh-huh.
But I guess but that was really
that was
more Yitzhak,
right.
that
was Yitzhak, not really Yaakov.
True.
Does
it say Yaakov here?
Yeah. Well,
Yaakov
maybe
Avinu,
it says Ma v'kesh lovan harami lasos liYaakov Avinu. So this is not exactly what you said, but sort of. It's not really on the same line. anybody else have another before I say my thing? Any other suggestions? Okay, good. So, basically, he wanted to try to steal everything, meaning when it says lakoris hakol, maybe lakoris hakol doesn't necessarily mean to kill him, maybe it means to uproot everything, to take everything that he has. Okay, so that could be. Wow. I thought it was a tame dog. Cheat. Anyway, so what I was going to say is a little bit similar in that direction, but a little bit different. This was mentioned by the, in different versions by the Malvin and also Rav Rimon. I think he said it on his own, which is not specifically that he wants to steal everything, but rather he wants to take them, he wants to control them. In what way did that happen? So the Malvin says, just the fact that, guess what? Who were the mothers of the Jewish people? I mean, who were Yaakov's wives? They were Rachel and Leah. So technically speaking, they weren't Jewish. Okay, again, what does that mean? I don't really know. But the Malbim basically says that they're not really Jewish because all the children, the Yudbet Shvatim, were from non-Jewish mothers. So they were from non-Jewish mothers. They weren't Jewish. The Lavan says they're all mine. Okay, that's very nice. Mm-hmm. Ramon's idea, I think I like even better. And basically he takes the Malbim a step further. I don't even remember if he mentions the Malbim. But basically what he says is that what Lavan was trying to do here was to say that everybody was an Aramean, meaning not only were they not Jewish technically, but fundamentally says they're all mine. They're mine. They're all mine. You know, the children, the kids' book, the different versions of this kids' book, you know, one I have a book which is about a dinosaur, one another thing, it's all mine, you know, the kids say, it's all mine, everything's mine. So Lavan says, it's all mine. They're all mine, okay? Yaakov, you're mine because your wives are my daughters and my grandchildren, and basically I don't want them to be Jews. I want them to be Arameans. I want to assimilate them and make them part of my culture. So if that's the idea, then the point of that's even more dangerous than Paro, because Paro was clear what he wanted to do. I mean, he did it in a very subtle way, but clearly, it says clearly in the Torah they wanted to basically kill all the boys. Lavan wanted to get rid of everybody, not necessarily in a physical way, but in a spiritual way, to say that everybody, all the Jews and all Yaakov's family should all be Arameans and not be Jewish, not be committed to God. And that's very, very scary. And maybe that's even worse in certain ways than Paro. That's what he wants to say. Just we always have to remember, especially in our generation, this obviously is where it's coming from, very, very dangerous. We see assimilation today as a terrible, terrible danger, and unfortunately it's gotten a lot of people, and it's something we have to be aware of, that we're out there in the world, and we have to make sure that we remain Jewish. Even if we're Jews, we have to remember that we identify as Jews and not just as Westerners or as, you know, secular culture or whatever it is. Anyway, so that's a side point, love and harami. What is the reason why this paragraph is here? I mean, what are we doing in the Haggadah at this point? So this paragraph, of course, is an introduction. Okay, what is this paragraph an introduction to? So look at the next paragraph, it's pretty obvious. Right? We say in the next paragraph, Shenamar Arami Oved Aviva Yerev Mitzrayma Vayever Shamim Seimat Vayhi Shamim Goygal Do'atzum Varav. So what is this part of the Haggadah now? Meaning now we've gotten to the Pesukim here. What is this section of the Haggadah? What is it doing now? What are we trying to do here? Anybody know? Look at your outline if you need, and you can look ahead by a couple of Pesukim just to understand what's happening here.
So taking apart the video recording.
Right. So before we get into that, just what's the goal of bringing these Pesukim here? The answer is we are now ready to tell the story, right? Now it's time to tell the story of Yetzias Mitzrayim. Okay? How do we get to that? So this pasuk of Arami Oved Avi basically gives us the background of how the Jews went down to Mitzrayim. And it starts with Lavan. According to the Haggadah, Arami Oved Avi basically means that in Aramean, Lavan tried to destroy my father being Yaakov. There are different explanations in the Mefarshim, there are other Perushim. Maybe the Arami is Yaakov himself rather than Lavan. Again, we're not going to go into that now. That's the Ibn Ezra says the Arami is Yaakov. And the Rashbam says the Arami is actually Avram Avinu. Again, a whole other explanation. But in the Haggadah, it's clearly referring to Yaakov. And this is what's happening. Basically, Yaakov went down to Mitzrayim, and then we're in Egypt. And that's the point of the Pesukim here. We're starting to tell the story of the slavery with this introduction. The question is that they ask, well, this is very nice, but why are we bringing Pesukim from, what you said, Josh, where are these Pesukim from? What context? Who says these Pesukim? And which holiday do they say it on? Remember? Mikra Bikurim, very good. They're from Dvarim, right? Parashas Kisavo. These are the psukim that the farmer says when he comes and brings his first fruits to the Beit HaMikdash on Shavuos or after Shavuos. So again, you have a question. Okay, this is very nice, but why are we bringing psukim that have to do with a farmer when we're talking about leaving Egypt? Okay, what does Shavuos have to do with Pesach? Oh. And by the way, this is all the way back to the Mishnah. Okay, the Haggadah didn't make this up. It's in the Mishnah. The Mishnah Mesachim says clearly that you darshan, you interpret the psukim of the parasha of Arami Oved Avi. So why do they choose this?
Circling around the Yetzias Mitzrayim, Shavuos and Dar,
let me ask you this. You're right, but where would you have expected on your own? Where would you have expected the main part of the Haggadah to come from? Which section of? Probably Shmos, right? Shmos is the actual story. And we see the Pesukim do come from Shmos, but not the core. The core comes from Dvarim, and then they use the Dvarim Pesukim, and then they throw in a few Pesukim from Shmos here and there and say, oh, well, this refers to that, and that's what it says in Shmos.
They say that Dvarim was written all by Moshe, and that he wrote it all, right? Like Mishneh Torah.
Right.
Maybe that when you're saying it from a witness and you're saying it from the doer, it might be different.
As opposed to Shmos, which is what?
Hashem. Writing it. He himself saw it from above, you can say. And we Jews saw it from as witnesses.
Okay.
You might understand it more from Moshe's perspective.
So that's an interesting point. I would have said maybe the opposite, which we'll see in a minute. You know, that maybe it's better to get it from Hashem's perspective, but I understand what you're saying. I didn't see that answer. It's an interesting idea. Maybe that if Moshe was really writing Sefer Dvarim, so that Sefer Dvarim is from Moshe's perspective, I mean, the fact that he wrote it, he actually is saying this came, a human witness to what happened. Okay, it's an interesting idea. Again, I didn't see it, but it's an interesting possibility. Anybody else have any other suggestions?
Well, it's sort of like something that presumably people knew. It was sort of, everyone makes their declaration every year, or they bring the Torah. So they already knew it, so they're sort of unpacking it here to sort of remove it and sort of like pin things backwards a little bit.
Okay, interesting. That's also, I didn't think of that either. It's also an interesting point that it was very familiar to people. Again, in those days, most people were farmers, right? Not like today, where 1% of the population here is farmers. Okay, that's another interesting idea. Yeah? Okay, so that's another interesting idea, that the first fruits are symbolic and similar to the idea that we are, this was the first of the Jewish people. I mean, Pesach is the beginning. We are the first. Hashem is the first. This is the first month, the first holiday, the first everything. That's an interesting idea. Okay, very, very interesting. I didn't think of that either. But that could also be that there's some idea of the fact that it's first is something which is important to emphasize here. Okay, good. Anybody else? So I'll give you some more simple explanations, but they were nice and nice ideas. There's something very simple. What would happen if we gave all the Pesukim to Sefer Shmos? What would our Sefer look like? How long would it be? you don't want to know, right? You thought it was long now. What's going to happen if you come from Sefer Shmos and you read, you know, 7 or 8 Prukim from Sefer Shmos straight? Okay, it's going to be a little bit difficult, right? So what do they do, according to this explanation? So they say, basically, that what happens here is we take a small little summary, a short little thing of a few Pesukim, to summarize the entire story of Mitzrayim. And it's there, by the way, we'll see in a minute, that in the Pesukim, we actually have divided into like 4 different categories the entire story. And it's organized very, very nicely in the Pesukim. We'll see in a second. So that's one idea. Maybe it's just practical to have, you know, Sefer Shmos as not practical to have Sefer Shmos, and better to have this. What else could it be, though? What's interesting about this story? Whose name is mentioned all over Sefer Shmos and not mentioned in these couple of psukim here?
Moshe.
Right? This is the opposite of what I was saying that you said, but this is what I meant by the opposite. Why do you think that it might be important that the Haggadah chose a section of psukim where Moshe's name is not mentioned?
Because you might think that Moshe had, because of Moshe, we were free, not because of Moshe.
Exactly, right. Maybe the Haggadah is trying to stress here, and it's clear throughout these psukim that Moshe is not the one in charge. Meaning, yes, we know that Hashem is in charge, but if you thought about B'nai Yisrael's perspective, B'nai Yisrael might have thought in a certain way, basically, yeah, Hashem is up there, but Moshe is the one that took us out. He's the one that they complained to. He's the one that they said thank you to. He's the one that was there every second. They didn't actually see Hashem. So in order to get around it, it could be what we need to emphasize is that even though Moshe was in some form the helper, but HaKadosh Baruch Hu was the one in charge. And these psukim show that very, very clearly. As opposed to in Sefer Shmos, if you took the psukim there, every other pasuk, Moshe is doing something. And that's not really the goal of the Seder. That's not the goal of the Haggadah. So that could be another very, very important reason why these psukim are mentioned.
That's interesting that Moshe wrote the
so that's why I said that what I think is exactly the opposite. Again, there's different interpretations of exactly what Moshe did with Sefer Dvarim. It could be he wrote it and Hashem agreed. Hashem told him what to write, but Moshe said it. There's all sorts of explanations about how to deal with that. But again, you could still say that even though Moshe wrote it, but he's not emphasizing his own role, though. He's emphasizing Hashem's role.
The fact that it was written by Moshe, he was taking himself out of the
picture. Ah, I see what you're saying. Right, right. Okay, good. Very nice. I mean, Moshe is specifically taking it from the other perspective, not including himself. Good. Okay, last idea, and this is a long one, which we're not going to say the whole thing. It's just in like two lines. Rav Soloveitchik has a very, very famous idea here. At least he used to be famous 40 years ago. I don't know how many people know about it today. But he had a famous drasha called the Nine Aspects of the Haggadah. Have you heard of it?
No.
You never heard of it? Oh,
no,
wow. Again, it used to be very famous. Right, yeah, it used to be very famous, but I think it's been a long time ago. That's not one of the ones that made it so famous anymore. Basically, Rav Soloveitchik has a whole discussion about this section and why the Haggadah chooses Aram Yehovi Adavi. And one of the things he tries to develop is that what was the goal of the farmer saying this declaration when he brought his first fruits? What was he trying to do? Why was he saying these psukim? What was he trying to do? Why? What was the point? So what?
Please, they can thank Hashem for the fruit.
Exactly. So what's the point? It's thanking HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Okay, so Rav Soloveitchik basically develops the idea that just like the farmer is supposed to recognize that he came a long way from the roots of the people in Mitzrayim, and now he came all the way to Eretz Yisrael, and now he brings his first fruits, and he says, thank you Hashem for giving me this opportunity. So we say also in the Haggadah, it's the same idea, to remember where we come from, and to say we also came from the slaves in Egypt, and just like the farmer, we're expressing our thanks, so too we also are doing the same thing. We're expressing our thanks to Hashem for everything from where we've come from until we get to now, which is very, very similar to what the farmer is trying to do. So that's another nice idea that that you can mention about this. Okay. Let's talk about the psukim for a few minutes. So pasuk number one, we just said, by Mitzrayim, we went down, by Yagrasham Sema'at, we lived there with a few people, by Hisham Magogal of Tzumvarab, and we became very great, meaning we started very small, we became very great. Look at the drashas in the psukim that the Haggadah makes here. Okay, we're not going to look at them all and analyze them all, even though there's what to say about every single one of these. But just get the overall sense. It says Vayera Mitzrayim. Okay, he meaning Yaakov went down to Mitzrayim. Okay, and he lived there, and there were very few people, and then they became a great nation. That's very nice. And now look what the Haggadah says. The Haggadah says Vayera Mitzrayim. He went down Anus al pi hadibur. Okay, he was forced by Hashem by the divine word. He was forced to go down. What divine word? Where did Hashem force him to go down to Egypt? Vayagar Hashem. Okay, and he went down and says, oh, Hashem, Yaakov only decided to, you know, he only wanted to stay there for a little while. We are out of Yaakov, you know, el-lishtakeshan, el-lagurshan. He only wanted to live there for a little bit, for a little while. Why is that going to bring that in here? Bim se'ma'at, with a small number of people. Kamash and Emirat says, 70 people, shiv nefshar yovasecha. 70 people, so small. Vahisham goy, and they became great. Milan shal yisrael mitzuyanim sham, they became great there. They had so many babies. They became very, very big. And the Medrash says there were six babies that were born at once. Where's the Haggadah going with this? Meaning, what is the goal of the Haggadah in these psukim here? What are we trying to do? First question, what is the stage that we're talking about? I mean, what stage of slavery is this right here? Is this the actual slavery of these psukim? No. This is the development of the Jews in Egypt. Okay, understand this is stage one in the psukim, which is basically the Jews coming down to Egypt and becoming into a lot and turning from 70 people, which is basically like a family, and turning into a nation. How did it happen? So what's the goal of the Haggadah here? Why is the Haggadah choosing these lines to darshan from the psukim? Meaning the Haggadah seems to have an agenda here. What's the Haggadah's agenda? What's the Haggadah trying to show us? What do you think? especially the first one, especially if it's just the first line, Anus al Piyadibur, but even the rest of them also. Where are we going with this? I mean, if I read these two, I read these psukim, Vayavar Shom Simaat, I wouldn't be saying what the Haggadah is saying here, not exactly in the same way. Where is Haggadah, where is he? He's pushing us in a certain direction.
It wasn't our choice. It was him. So
exactly. Right. I think that's
setting up
I think that's exactly the point. I think the point is that HaKadosh Baruch Hu, exactly what we said before, HaKadosh Baruch Hu is setting the stage here for something, nothing to do with what we did. Okay, Vayera Mitzrayim, Yaakov went down to Egypt. Hashem forced him to go down. Where did it say that Hashem forced him to go down? We have no idea. If you look at Parshas Vayigash and Parshas Vayechi, nowhere does it say Hashem told Yaakov, go down to Egypt, or else. No, it doesn't say that. He doesn't threaten him. What'd you say? Okay, but he didn't go down until they found that Yosef was there. What really happened?
That's how I'm to go.
Well, yes, but no. I mean, you're right. The Mepharshim do say that. Okay, if you look at the...
And the night before he goes down, he's scared. There's some problems. Don't be scared. Go down anyway.
Exactly. So you look at the Rishpah. Right. So the Rishpah, the Tarsh Chama got it. So the Rishpah basically says that he said there's two ideas here you could say. The Rishpah says that basically the idea was that Yaakov actually knew that the flavor was going to happen. He knew about the Rishpah of Asarim, and he did it anyway. And others say that I don't remember who said it. I'm sorry, the Abu Dram. The Abu Dram says, I think what Josh said and what you said also, that Hashem tells Yaakov, Anochi Eredi Mecha Mitzrayim, I will go down with you to Egypt, Vanochi Alcha Gavalo, and I will take you up afterwards. Or he says, don't be scared to go down to Egypt. Same sukkim in Parshas Vayigash. But that doesn't mean that he forced him to go down. What happened was that Yaakov was scared. And Hashem is sort of giving him, you know, an ishur, so to speak, an ishur nisiyah. He says, you can leave Eretz Yisrael. That's not being forced. So what happens here? So I think what's going on here is that the Haggadah is sort of twisting the pshat around to say that even though on the surface it doesn't look like Yaakov was forced, but really he was forced. How is he forced?
They ran out of food.
They ran out of food, but again, in addition to that, they weren't ready to leave yet until he found out that Yosef was there.
He put Yosef there.
Exactly. So I think that's where this is getting to. But the whole point is that Haggadah wants us to realize that HaKadosh Baruch Hu, what you said, created the whole situation in such a way that Yaakov had no choice. He did it of his own accord. He chose to go down, but that's only because the situation turned into a situation that Hashem made for him, that he felt that he wanted to go because Yosef was there, he had no food. Basically, he says, I have no choice, and I'm going to choose to go. And I want Hashem's, you know, I want Hashem to be sure. I want Hashem to tell me that it's okay. And he does. Hashem tells him it's okay. But we have to realize, looking deeper into the surface, that it's not that Yaakov wanted to go and Hashem said, yes, okay, you can go, you have my permission. Rather, Hashem made the whole situation for him. That's what the Haggadah and slavery and the whole background is all about. Looking at HaKadosh Baruch Hu from, you know, beneath the surface, and even the parts that we don't see Hashem, he's there. He's making the whole thing happen. Same idea of Vayagrasham to the same Vayagrasham. Yaakov only went down for a short time, and what happened? He didn't plan on staying. But Hashem had other plans. Hashem had plans that they had to go through the slavery, and therefore they ended up staying there a little bit longer. Bimseimat, 70 people, turned into 600,000. How did that happen? So again, the Midrashim say, where it says, Paruba Yishadjuva Yibuva Yilatsvayas, move, mode, mode, that they had miracles there, that there were six babies born in, you know, at one time. That's a miracle. HaKadosh Baruch Hu is trying to make them into a nation. That's what's basically happening here. Again, we're skipping some points, obviously, along the way. But you get the basic idea of where these paragraphs are going, and where the Baal HaGadah, I think is going with these psukim here, which again is an amazing thing. If you think about it, you know, there's a real point here. There's a real direction of where the Haggadah is doing and how we're supposed to understand what happened. Any questions before we go on? Okay. Again, there's lots of nice Divrei Torah. If I send you my stuff afterwards, you can see the other Divrei Torah that I have here on the other parts here. Go to the next pasuk. What stage of the slavery is this? I mean, what are we describing here?
Beginning. They started work.
So it's actually not just the beginning. Look at the next pasuk. Vayitzak el Hashem Elokeinu v'Seinu v'Yishma Hashem es Kolenu.
So
the whole slavery is encapsulated in 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 8 words. That's it. The whole thing. They oppressed us. Vayareyu Hashem. They bat us. Vayanunu. They oppressed us. Vaynu leinu v'dakasha. And they did. And they gave us hard work. So again, what the Haggadah did here, and what the Pesukim do basically, is take the entire slavery and put it into one pasuk. Okay? And this is stage two. Again, I told you before that the psukim are very, very well organized, and you see that this is the stage. This is the whole slavery. The first stage was the going down and becoming the Jewish people, and this stage is the slavery. What does Haggadah do with this? So here, again, we're not going to go into all of them here, but you look at the drushes that they give, and they say, Kamash and Emar, Havan is Chakmalo, we should be Chacham, Ten Yer Bev, Ayaki Sikrenim, Lechamav and Asakam, who also in Enu, because we're afraid that the Jews are going to become our enemy, they're going to leave Egypt, and they're going to fight us, etc., 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 etc. What do we see from this whole thing? And the next part also, the next paragraph,
They gave taskmasters in order to oppress them, and they built the Pisom and Ramses. And then the next stage, it says, "Vayavidu mitzrayim es bnei Yisrael b'farach." You said before times slavery, but in the Pesukim we see that there are different stages. Okay, it starts slow, and then slowly it gets to the point that they have hard labor. Okay, why did the Egyptians do it that way? And why is this Havanis Chakma? Why are they being Chakma?
If you went straight on to the hard work, they have a rebellion.
Ah, exactly. They did it slow.
The Jews are
right.
Huge.
Right. So that's exactly what happened. The Egyptians were smart about it. And this, by the way, is what anti-Semitism has been in many places, you know, throughout the years. Not always, but often. It starts slow, and you have to do it in a very smart, in a very wise way. Because if you don't do it slowly and carefully, then it won't work. Either because the Jews won't, they'll rebel
the
in some way, or the rest of the nation will say, you can't do that. There are people. That's what happened certainly in Germany in the Holocaust. This is for sure what happened with the Nazis. For sure. So the Egyptians also say, let's take it slow. And first, let's start by basically, you know, we'll get them to build. And the Midrashim say here, the Abu Dram, I think, quotes this, the Midrashim that say that the very first day, I found this, by the way, one of my kids' books also that I was looking at yesterday. One of the kids' books says this also. You know, says, oh, well, power decided, okay, so let's get them to go work. I'll go down the first day, and I'll start building the pyramid myself. And we'll say, oh, everybody come join me. And they, oh my gosh, the king is building. I can't believe it. We got to go, you know, that's not covered to the Malchus. We got to go help him. So they all go and help him. And at the end of the day, power gives them money. He pays them for their work. And they say, great, let's go again tomorrow. So the next day, power comes again. But this time, power doesn't do any work. He just stands there, and they do all the work. And at the end, they say, okay, can we get paid, please? Where's our money? Where's the gelt? And they say, I'm sorry, no more money for you. And the next day, power's gone, and now they're, you know, hitting them, and they're making them build, and they say, they're the same amounts of bricks that you built the first day when you were all enthusiastic about it, and you had lots of energy, now you got to do that every single day. Very, very slow, and very cunning. Okay, chacham. That's what it's all about. And that's what the Mitzrayim did, and that's how they got the Jewish people into this mess. That's what they say, and eventually it was Vayavidu Mitzrayim es bnei Yisrael b'farach. One little point about this, which Rav Rimon points out here, is that when you deal with, it says Vayareu Osona HaMitzrim Vayanunu. Okay. What does Vayareu Osona HaMitzrim mean? Vayareu Otanu. Was it?
They made it bad for us.
Yeah. So they made it bad for us. Vayareu Osona HaMitzrim. How would you say that? The correct grammar, though. How should you say it? They made it bad for us. Not Vayareu Otanu, but rather Vayareu Lanu. They made it bad for us. What does Vayareu Otanu mean?
They made us bad.
So Rav Rimon points out, and I saw this also in the Chama Leibowitz. I think she got it from the Hamek Dover. I think it was just the Chama Leibowitz and Rav Cook. I'm sorry, Rav Cook also says this. That what does that mean? It means this was part of the Egyptians' plan. It means they made the Jews bad. How did they make the Jews bad? It means they basically made the Jews fight against each other. They had Jews that were the Nogsim. The Jews were sometimes the ones that were in charge of telling the other Jews what to do. And they said, you got to make this quota of bricks. And if you don't make this quota of bricks, you're going to get punished. Jew versus Jew, and they made it such that the Jews themselves felt bad now. They were up and doing all the crimes themselves. Very, very difficult. And if you think of this is exactly such a striking parallel to, again, to the Holocaust and the Nazis, what did the Nazis do? Exactly the same thing, right? They made the Jewish people in charge. They called the Kapos, right? That's what they're called, right? They're the ones that were in charge of making sure that all the Jews did what they were supposed to do, and if not, then the Kapos would actually punish them. And this was a big tension throughout the war. You know, some Kapos were very good and some Kapos were terrible, and they hit them and they yelled at them and they screamed and whatever. But what happened? The enemy made us bad. They made us bad against each other. And when you do that, then you're stuck. The Jews are stuck because not only can they keep their righteousness, they themselves are losing, and slowly they're losing their feeling of, you know, moral superiority by the enemy's actions. And that's what's, you know, some of the tragedy about what the Mitzrayim did here. Okay, let's quickly go on here. Any other comments on that? Again, so I'm throwing at you a lot of points here. I think a lot of these points are nice. The next point, "Vanitzak al Hashem Elokei Avoseinu, Yishma Hashem es Kolenu v'yaras v'yinu v'yaras v'yinu v'yaraseinu." It says, we cry out to Hashem. So what's stage three here? What's the goal of stage three, Pasuk? What's this Pasuk all about?
Redemption.
Ah, well, what do the Jews do? What is this? Okay, basically it's us crying out and HaKadosh Baruch Hu hearing us. Okay, nothing happened yet. But this is really the turning point. Okay, the turning point is that we cried out to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and then Hashem heard us. He heard our cry, Vayaras Anyenu, he saw our difficulties, Vesamalinu es Lachatzenu. So if you look at the Haggadah here, so the Haggadah, again, there's lots of things we could say about this, but just give you one or two points. So then the Haggadah says, Vayinzak al Hashem Elokei Avoseinu, that Shenemar Vayihi Bayamim Ravim Ahem, that the Egyptian king died, whatever that means, the machlokas, if that means he died or he just had saras, and the Jews were, you know, they groaned. They had a tough time. They were crying out because of the slavery. They cried out, and they cried out because of the avodah. So I'll give you one point and then a second point. What does it say that the Jews cried out about here? What did they cry about according to this pasuk?
About the work.
Yeah, they cried about the work. I mean, why are they crying? They were crying about the work. What does it say that Hashem saw? Vayaras onyenu v'samalenu v'slachasein. That Hashem saw the onyenu, amalenu v'slachasein. What are those things? So look at the next thing. First it says, Vayishma Hashem is kolenu. And it says, Vayishma lokim is nakasam. Vayishkor lokim is brisot ha'avram is Yaakov. Fine. But then it says, Vayaras onyenu. We saw onyenu. What's onyenu? Zu prishus derech eretz. That's the prishus derech eretz. What's that? And this refers to the lack of marital relations. This refers to the fact that the Jews separated from their wives. That's Prishus Derech Eretz. Some say it means the Jews did it of their own accord. Some say that the Egyptians forced them.
Like
what
was the passage before? It has that same sharash.
Which one?
So
here, it's mainly addressed on the word Vayar. It says Hashem saw. And we have the same passage in Shmos earlier. Vayar Elokim is B'nei Shavayidah Elokim. And Vayidah Elokim, in other places in Tanakh, refers to knowing, refers to having relations. So here Hashem saw not just their crying, but also the derech eretz, meaning their lack of husband and wife being together. Esam aleinu, our difficulties, our troubles. Elu habanim, those are children. What does that mean? The fact that call you habena yilud ayor tashlichu, the fact they were going to kill all the boys. Veslachatzenu zohar zechak, the pressure. What's this pressure? What does that mean? Shenor vagam aris talach asher v'tam nochatim osam. That's the pressure of the time, okay? The time pressure. They couldn't do whatever they wanted. They were pressured by the Egyptians. So look at this. What did the B'nai Israel cry about, and what did Hashem see?
Cried about the hard work.
They cried about the hard work, and what did Hashem see when he's trying to figure out? Hashem saw not just the work, he saw all these other things. He saw the lack of marital relations, the lack of husband and wife together. He saw the problem with the children. He saw the problem with the time pressure. Why didn't the Jews cry about those things?
Because they cried about the work. If we don't have this, will feel better. Right? They're not dreaming of having that extra level of the house.
Okay. So Rav Soloveitchik has a beautiful idea here, which I'm not going to read to you, obviously, but if you want to look it up, it's in the English Rav Soloveitchik Haggadah, I think. Either Rabbi Ganax Haggadah or Rabbi Albert Haggadah. There's a few of them. Which one it's in? Or Rav Rimonko, it's also in Hebrew. Basically what he says is that the Jewish people were so far removed from normal existence that they forgot to cry out about the fact they were separated from their wives and about the children. Meaning they were so used to the existence of slavery, of sleeping out of the fields, the Midrashim say that they slept out of the fields so they'd make sure to get their bricks done in time, and the wives were at home, and sometimes they came out to the fields, and sometimes they had relations in the fields, and they gave birth to their babies in the fields, which was a really special thing. But you know, whatever happened, though, the point was that the men didn't realize it was so part of their what they did that they didn't even realize it was a problem. And they didn't realize the whole problem with the time pressure. It was just part of life. They didn't even think to cry about it. It was so far removed from crying out. The only thing they cried about it was the work, because they said, "Oh, our backs hurt. We have to cry." And Rav Soloveitchik says that's what HaKadosh Baruch Hu sees from the slavery. Hashem doesn't just see what's on the surface. Hashem sees the real issues. And the real issues here are not just the physical labor, it's also the mental and the emotional difficulties that they were going through. And that's why it says Hashem understood that, and Hashem helped them for that reason as well. And that's also sometimes something we have to remember, that sometimes we don't always cry out about the things that are most important. We get so used to things that are, you know, a certain way, even when it's not right way, that we forget to even cry about it and complain and say this is wrong, we have to change it. Okay, that's what happens, that's what everybody does, and we don't even realize that maybe it shouldn't be that way, we've got to change something. This is an important point to think about in terms of that. And the last point in terms of this also, Rev. Ramon points this out as well, is that what are the three things that Hashem saw here? He saw the problem of marital communication and being together, couples being together, the children and time. He said those are three things which basically are all that what a free person has. A free person has control over their relationship with their spouse, over their children, and over their time. And what did the Egyptians do? They took away all three. Meaning, again, they were missing their freedom in the most basic way. And that's also what we're trying to see about HaKadosh Baruch Hu, who saw all those three things and wanted to take us out of that. Okay. We have a few minutes left. Let's see what else we can do here. Vayotzi Hashem Mitzvah Gerach HaZakav Zeran HaTziyav Mar HaGadol VeOsos HaMosim. Hashem took us out. So stage four here.
I feel safer. I feel
until you get to a certain point.
We'll keep moving, right. All right, I'm happy to stay another hour, but I don't think it's a good idea. So. Anyway, so the last pasuk, what's the last pasuk about? What's the goal of the last pasuk? Stage 4, this is the redemption. Okay. Again, without going through all the things here, what's the theme of the Haggadah here, of all these things? So the main thing, and there are a few points here, but the main theme, the Haggadah says, Lo yedei malach, it's not a malach, it's a saraf, it's not a shliach, there's no messenger, it's Hashem himself. Hey, wait, what happened to Moshe? Isn't Moshe the messenger? So what's the point here? The point of the Haggadah is that in the context of the Seder and Jewish history, who's in charge?
Sure.
It's HaKadosh Baruch Hu, right? Meaning there's no messenger, there's no Moshe. Moshe doesn't exist. Kiwu. What does that mean, he doesn't exist? It means he's not even a messenger when it comes to understanding what happened. Moshe went to Paro and told him what Hashem said. He took the people out by basically just saying, okay, come with me, and I'll tell you what God says to do. But he didn't actually do anything. He didn't do anything. Yes, he picked up his staff and made some makas happen. But he didn't do anything. He just picked up the staff. Hashem did it. That's the point of the Seder. Everything is a kind of miracle. And that's a very, very important point to keep in mind as we go through here. Okay. We're going to skip all the rest of this stuff. There's a lot of interesting questions here about, yeah, don't do this at your Seder yourself, obviously. right. a lot of interesting things along the way here about Dever and Cherub. Anyway, skipping to the Esther Makos. So we have Esther Makos here. They're mentioned at this point in the Seder because this is obviously the point of, this is the main theme of the Jewish people coming out from Mitzrayim, that this is what HaKadosh Baruch Hu caused the Mitzrayim to undergo and to suffer. And essentially this is part of what the lesson was of the Jews leaving Egypt, was not just the Jews leaving, but also the fact that who's in charge? It's Hashem. Same idea, that Hashem's in charge. So from the Esther Makos, we see both the Jews and the Egyptians both learned that Hashem is in charge in three different ways, which we don't have time for now, but if you can look at my notes later. Basically, there's three ways that the Makos deal with this, which is basically at the Tzach Hadash Ba'achav, that each group of Makos is a theme. The first theme is there is Hashem. The second theme is that Hashem knows how to make things happen in the world. And the third theme is basically Hashem can do whatever he wants. He can make things that are crazy, that are nothing else like it in history. He can make those things happen also. Again, I just give you a whole hour shiur in like 5 seconds. Basically, you can look, Ramon has a really beautiful chart here about this. It's also in Nehemiah Benel and a bunch of Mepharshim. This idea that each group of Makos has a theme. So that's part of the point of the Makos here, of showing those themes and showing that Hashem is in charge and everybody is punished. The next three paragraphs have this whole story of why, how do we know that the Egyptians had 10 Makos in Mitzrayim, and then they had 50 makas on the sea, and they had 200 makas on the sea, and 250 makas. What is going on here? Why do we care how many makas the Egyptians had? Any ideas? Excellent. So that's what, I think it's the Malbim who says that. The Vilagon says that because the Pasuk says that anything that happens to the Egyptians, I'm not gonna let happen to you. So we're interested in trying to make the most makas possible that happens to the Egyptians. That would be to our best interest so that we don't get those makas as well. The other explanations that are given here are to show us that Hashem, the more that Hashem gave makas to the Egyptians, the more that he saved us. That really maybe we should have gotten punished also, because we were almost as bad as they were at that point. And yet, every single time that the Egyptians got makas, we did not get makas. Which basically means we have to thank HaKadosh Baruch Hu even more for every makas that the Egyptians got that we didn't get. And that, of course, moves right into Dayena. And that's the next paragraph from the Haggadah, which is Kama Malos Tovus L'makom Aleinu. Okay, we should be so happy that Hashem gave us all these different things. If he gave it, he took us out of Mitzrayim, but he didn't punish their gods, that would be enough. And if he punished their gods, but he punished them, but he didn't punish their gods, etc., etc., etc. If he killed their Bechoros, and if he gave us their money, but he didn't split the sea for us, it would be enough, etc., etc., etc. Is that really true? Would it really have been enough if he had not given us the Torah, if he had not gotten us away from the Egyptians? What does that mean, it would have been enough? Anybody know what?
Thank you.
Oh, exactly. So that's what the Malbim says, basically. That it means it would have been enough to say thank you. And the additional point here, and this also where Rimon says beautifully, that the point is not just to say thank you, but also to realize that each step along the way is an important part of the Geula. Each step, even if by itself it doesn't seem to be so significant, the fact is you have to recognize that is a stage in the Geula. The fact that that Hashem punished part of them, the fact that Hashem gave us their money, the fact that we got to Har Sinai even before we got the Torah. Every single one of those stages is a stage along the way to Geula and coming to Eretz Yisrael. And this is, again, a critical lesson for Bizman Hazeh, and really throughout Jewish history, but especially today, that every stage is part of the Geula and it's part of the plan,
and every stage is important. At every stage you have to thank you for it. Every single part of the way, even if it's not the complete redemption, you must say thank you for and appreciate what HaKadosh Baruch Hu has given you and realize why it's one stage above what happened before that. And again, it's such an important lesson for in a few weeks, we get to Yom HaSmut, Yom Yerushalayim, but have it in mind now to really be able to thank HaKadosh Baruch Hu for every single stage along the way, even if it's not complete, even if there are still things that are missing. Again, I think it's a very, very important and beautiful point that comes out of the Haggadah here. We almost did it, right? 10:17, like 3 more minutes. I'll tell him, we can do it, right? At least it's not Chatzos yet. Okay, we're Zechat, this is 10:20. All right, let's move it. So Gamliel, so the Haggadah has it towards the end here, but Gamliel Haya Omer, anybody that didn't say these three things has not fulfilled his obligation. Okay? So this is, according to many, this is a very important part of the Haggadah. We mentioned at the beginning a few weeks ago that you have to say, according to most poskim, because he said you have not been Yotzei if you don't mention these three things, because Pesach, Matzah, and Maror are, let's say, three of the most critical parts of the Haggadah. Which chiyuv have you not fulfilled your obligation for here? When it says, what do you say? Okay, so many Rishonim say that it refers to the Sibur Yetzias Mitzrayim. That's the Pashup Shat, that you haven't fulfilled your mitzvah of telling the story if you have not told the story of these three things. Okay? But the Rashbam and a few others say that's actually not what it means. It doesn't refer to the mitzvah of telling the story, rather it refers, what do you say? The mitzvah of eating the three things, yeah. Of Pesach, eating the Pesach, eating the Matzah, eating the Maror. So according to some of the it's a minority opinion. The Maharsha, I think, in the Gemara Pesachim also says something like this. Maybe it's in Brachos, I don't remember where. They say basically, in order to fulfill the complete mitzvah of eating Matzah and eating Maror, you have to talk about it. Either way, what's the point? Why, if the mitzvah of talking about it, do you have to talk about the foods? Why can't you just eat them? Mm-hmm. And why, if the mitzvah is to eat the food, why do you have to talk about them? Mm-hmm. Anybody? Right. But the point is, it's in addition, meaning you can't just, what do you say?
It's not just about eating food. It's understanding the symbol, the message. That's true for Pesach.
Okay, good. Good. I would say even a little more than that. I would say that it's also about, you have to have both elements. You have to have an element of learning about it, and you also have the experiential element. You have to feel it, and you have to eat it. By eating it, you re-experience being in Mitzrayim and feeling it, and by learning about it, you have the intellectual component. And the point of the Haggadah is you have to have both. You can't just have one without the other. You have to learn Talmud Torah in the Haggadah, but you also have to feel. You have to have the emotion. You have to have the experience. You have to feel like you were there. And in order to do that, you have to have both elements. And that's why Rambam Gamliel is so important here, that he says you have to do three. And this is also the four stages of the Seder. Ramon also talks about this a little bit, that this is the experiential stage of the Seder. The middle part with all the drushas, that was the intellectual stage. At the beginning, the geula, we talked about the physical freedom, the spiritual freedom, the intellectual freedom, or the intellectual stage of learning, and now we have the experiential, of feeling it. And this is the fourth point in the Haggadah, of Rambam Gamliel, of looking at all the three sides, but basically each one of the three things, we understand what the point was, and the fact that we have to eat it and talk about it at the same time should give us a double flavor of how to feel Yetzias Mitzrayim in a very, very, very real way. Okay, a lot more to say here about those things, but we're going to skip them for now. And just to look at the end of the Haggadah, so basically you have the last couple of paragraphs here of the Chol Dor Derchav, the Lirus Atzav Mokilu Yetzav Mitzrayim, that you have to think, you have to believe as if you were, as if you actually yourself left Mitzrayim, which again goes exactly with what we just said before, about the three paragraphs of eating and talking about it to make yourself feel that you were there. That's exactly what the Haggadah says here, which is based on the Gemara and Pesachim, and the Mishnah Pesachim, which basically says this point, that you have to feel that you left. And again, that's the significance of Pesach as opposed to, let's say, Sukkos, where here you can't just talk about it, you actually have to feel it and re-experience it. And that's what they say here. And then the paragraph goes right on to that. Because of that, this is what the Maharal says, Lefichach, because of the fact that we actually were there, because of the fact that we have to re-experience it, therefore we have a special obligation in the next paragraph, to praise Hashem in all these different ways for doing all these miracles for us, etc., etc., etc. Because we actually experienced it, we should, much more so than somebody telling a story of something that happened 2,000 years ago, we should really be able to praise Hashem the same way we were there. And that's what people are so excited about Yom HaSmut, Yom Yerushalayim, because they're in our generation, we feel it much more. Ideally, the way it's supposed to be is that we get so into the Pesach Seder and the story that we feel it there as much as well. And that's why they say, the Noah in the front of Shira Chadasha Haleluka, we see a new song. The Shira Chadasha, the new song is what, of course? What's the next paragraph in the Haggadah? Hala! Is that a new song? It's an old song, right? That was around many years ago. Why is it a new song? So they say, you can guess.
Well, we left.
If we really are supposed to believe that we left, then the way we're supposed to be seeing it, exactly, right, we're not supposed to be seeing it as, oh, we're reading Psukim in Hallel and Tehillim. We're supposed to be seeing it the way that we would have said it ourselves had we been there, and it's like spontaneously coming out of our mouth. That's the way the Hallel is supposed to be, ideally, that it just comes out and it's like totally normal and totally natural that we're saying the words rather than just reading them, but feeling them and say, wow, Hashem, you're so great. This is how we feel because we just went through it. That's a Shira Chadash, it's a new song. We should get to the point where we can feel that it's a new song and appreciate everything that Hashem has done for us. And then we get to the paragraph right afterwards of the Geula and thank HaKadosh Baruch Hu for redeeming us. And we should thank Hashem for the previous Geula. We should be zochah to the future Geula in our times and very, very soon. Okay. Yes, Shakar. Sorry for rushing.